The following program was produced by Clock Tower Radio, clocktower.org, and is broadcast in partnership with Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM.
This is Charles Ruas welcoming you to a program from my audio archives from the 1970s. As Director of Arts Programming at WBAI FM, the Pacifica radio station in New York City, I produced programs that covered all the contemporary arts, including drama, literature, and experimental radio programs as well. John Giorno's Dial a Poem, Part 6. In the days when you could dial a recipe, dial for a suicide hotline, dial for anything, John Giorno had the brilliant illumination that people, instead of dialing a prayer, could actually dial a poem.
The Reading Experiment. Dial a Poem Poets, Part 6. In a conversation with Charles Ruas and Linda Perry, John Giorno, poet and originator of Dial a Poem Poets, discusses the concept behind his work and introduces the readings of Edwin Denby, Helen Adam, Diane DePrima, John Cage, Denise Levertov, Kenneth Koch, John Ashbery, and Charles Stein.
Come on.
John, in this program, I see that you've selected a number of established poets who work in a completely different style from yours, such as Edwin Denby and John Ashbery, Kenneth Koch. And I was wondering, who are the poets that you read?
Well, I don't read any poetry, and I haven't for years. What I do, though, is listen to poetry. I don't read much of anything, you know, and because I'm a poet, I'm into hearing it. But when I listen to the one goes to poetry readings, and somehow that's how I can relate to the sound of poetry. I mean, I know what it looks like on a page, you know, or what it would sound like, but, and the poets I like to listen to are very few even of those, you know, of people that I really like. And I can't think of any other than Burroughs, and Burroughs is a good friend of mine, and we read a lot together, so one is always hearing him, you know. Otherwise, it's just the way one chooses it is that there's no judgment. There's no good or bad judgment that this is good poetry and this is bad poetry. One tends to sort of psych out what's happening, you know? Like the poets that are on now are from the Edwin Denby to the John and Ashbery and Kenneth Koch. I mean, they're valid poets. I mean, they're, good or great poets or important American poets who are working now. And they have a voice. So one chooses in relation to the work that's in the whole range of their work, the important poems and ones that they've read, either interesting or well, or have some. So the poetry reading might have just historical significance in terms of space. You know, now it's these are, you might say, New York School of Poets. But there's the West Coast poets, and there's the Gary Snyder and the Philip Whalen and the San Francisco poets, and the poets out of anywhere, from, you know, Iowa City to Wisconsin or New Mexico or Nebraska. And then the inside of that, you have all your various approaches, you know, I mean, be it concrete poetry or found poetry or sound poetry, or just what, it's mostly what people are doing without making a judgment, except sort of picking up on the energy of it happening.
Thank you.
Well, I can't remember. It's probably years ago. And it might have been The Wild Boys, Burroughs' last novel, only because then I had to do that. I mean, because you tend to want to read the work of your friends. And then I don't even think I finished that, actually. I can't remember. Actually, one tends to read, you know, like I'm into Buddha Dharma and meditation, so one tends to read certain Buddhist books only because they have to do with a certain amount of information, basic information, the way it's sort of technology or scientific in a certain scientific in relationship that it's approach to sort of understanding your mind. It's sort of information. It's easier to be gotten like reading a manual, so to speak. But one stopped reading, you know, primarily in the early 60s because, like, there were so many other inputs. I mean, one before sort of the 1950s, say, I guess, you know, like in the early part of the century, going back for several hundreds of years, the only input that you had was through reading, you know, like through like when you read a novel, the actual people that you met in your life were very limited. You only knew a certain amount of people, even if you lived in New York, you know, and those were the group that you happened to be in or with or whatever, or if you lived in outside a small town in France or a small town in the Midwest or something, and that the way you sort of tuned into the sort of learning about people's minds or people's psyches or human nature, so to speak, was through books. You know, you read novels. That was the function of a novel, at least I think, you know. And that now, since, say, 1950 or 47, with the coming of television and the 30s, so to speak, and the coming of radio and movies and et cetera, the amount of information input through other forms of media and communication is enormous. So that one tended to, after one finished college, you know, one tended to stop reading because you had like 800 pages a day. Every day you're in college is required reading. Well, that's what you're supposed to. And you know where that led you? Nowhere, you know? Except that you just got this all this incredible amount of information from Chaucer or to the Restoration. It was great. I'm glad I learned all that, you know? But there was a point when there was nothing that this wasn't a conscious decision. There was nothing that I personally thought that I could gain. And I didn't even think that I could gain. You just sort of lost interest to it and slipped into the world of the, say, the 50s going into the 60s, which is when I got out of college, and all the input of, from all the various other media, and that thing that drugs did. And when you first started taking LSD in the early 60s and smoking dope, where, like, your communication with space, with all this other media and with people, it was another level.
But wasn't that due to the fact that you were closer to visual artists who were sort of at that time exploring areas that poetry wasn't as yet exploring?
Yeah, one's best friends at that time, you know, sort of from 1960 on, were like painters and sculptors, you know, the Andy Warhol, Bob Rauschenberg, Jasper, and they were just sort of beginning doing their work. I mean, they were just sort of these ordinary guys. But at the same time, it was New York, you know, and I'm from New York, one knew Frank O'Hara and John Ashbery and Kenneth Koch and Alan and et cetera. But somehow one was less interested in what they were doing and more interested emotionally or in every other way with what the painters were doing. Because in a certain way, what Brian Geisen said a number of years ago, back in the early 60s, that painting was 50 years ahead of poetry in terms of what de Kooning and the abstract guys and going back to the surreal guys to the all the way had done, poetry was just beginning. What was done in the early part of the century in painting and sculpture was just begun to be done in 1960 in poetry.
In America.
In America. Yes. And in Europe, too. There's odd examples of, you know, like Duchamp or dealing with words and Otto or whoever dealing with... But it wasn't sort of like what was happening in art and any of those things, you know, just relative large group of people and that there's a number of people working together in a very powerful way that changes the way things are done because it's a new approach and awareness is just slithered open and there's a new space to deal with.
You agreed that the visual arts were 50 years ahead And I think Susan Sontag recently wrote an article stating that, that in this country the literature is basically reactionary, whereas art is fundamentally revolutionary in that it's always experimental. Your own work and the work of the writers and poets with which you identify then are essentially linked to the experimentation in the visual art, so that you see it as forming a whole, a cultural scene that will influence everything else.
Yeah. Except that the artists and painters and the poets tend to like it separated right about now, like at the beginning of the 70s, because unfortunately all the great experimentation that was done in the plastic arts or the painting and sculpture stopped around 1967. And then all those guys who made just gigantic contributions, you know, like Jasper or Andy or Bob Rauschenberg, or going on later to the Larry Poons or something, their orientation was slightly incorrect in that they were totally into materialism, you know, and totally into objects, and actually with not too much mind. And when you look back in the retrospect, and so that they got bogged down, actually, with there's only so much you can do with materialism before it chokes you. And like now that the fact that all those guys' paintings sell for $200,000 at least, you know, or $120,000, and none of them have done anything, you know, in recent years of those guys, and that the newer generation, other than the revival of abstract expressionism in a certain sense in some of the galleries recently, or photorealism and all that, which is, you know, I'm not going to make any judgments on it. I mean, the most interesting thing in my mind that's happening in art in the last year or so, a couple of years, is conceptual art, because it's dealing with the whole process, you know, and not doing something with a square painting with paint on it that's worth a lot of money or that's essentially decoration at this point. And even though it was in decoration in 1958 or 1962 or 1965, when these guys were doing essentially, it's romantic to say heroic ideas, but they were just making statements which made everyone scream. I mean, those same statements now sell for $250,000, which is off the wall. In the meantime, poets, which, you know, like, you know, might be, as one has said, you know, like a lot, long time behind, have gone way ahead of that, because what they've done in like the last few years, only the last 3 or 4 or 5 years, is in each in their own way have gotten into the concept of mind and their own mind and life and meditation on whatever way you want to take it. I mean, any form of meditation, and which is seems to me closer to the essence, real essence of what things are about. So it's not that one is caught up and one has gone back. It's that I think actually poets now are where it's at. I mean, like what they've been doing with their minds and with their work in the last few years is much more valid than anything that's happened in art in the last 10 years.
I agree with you that the most extraordinary contemporary work is being done in conceptual art. However, in poetry, there is a return to materialism in the sense that so many poets have been influenced by both culturally rock music and to theatrics, the theatrics of performance, so that you can see that the cult of the performer, the performance, which originated with Warhol, you know, dressed in silver, with silver hair, etc., has now come back to us with a vengeance in the proliferation of performing poets.
Yeah, well, those things are always after the fact. I mean, that has happened. One way you can look at it, which is the way I look at it, is that it's all sort of a dance, you know? Like, poets are just really dancing better now, or dancing now where they didn't dance before. And when it does solidify in terms of cult, and, you know, like, and the poets start getting as famous as the artists, it tends to be after the fact, you know? Like, whatever the poet has done, and if he indeed has solidified as a cult, culture hero, so to speak, it is after his importance, what he has done, and the importance has already been done. I mean, it's been the razor blade that's cut through the materialism in people's mind, and then he may go on to get fucked up. But what tends to happen with poets is not what happens with artists, is because poets never get paid for anything, you know. I mean, as far as poetry readings, all of us who give poetry readings, we get paid absolutely nothing, you know? I mean, we get paid still, you know, Ann Wall and myself, we just get $300, $400, $500. And how many readings do we have a year, you know? Burroughs gets maybe a couple of hundred dollars more than that. And he only has a few readings a year, ultimately. I mean, it's Berkeley and San Francisco and New York and Boston and Philadelphia, and that's it, you know. Allen Ginsberg is one of the few people who is, because he's been at it for so many years, has really extended it, the performance, into something other than that. And the things that poets never get paid the way artists do. No poet ever makes $80,000 a year. I mean, like Bob Rauschenberg and Jasper and all those guys have been making $100,000 to $250,000 a year every year for the last 18 years. And, like, that has an incredible impact on, like, your psyche, you know, just having that much money to spend off the cuff, you know. And you tend to, it tends to sort of get into then sponsoring lifestyles. I mean, when you make $100,000 a year, you have to spend it. And you spend it, it becomes a lifestyle, then it becomes cult, then it becomes poets, no matter who you are. But William Burroughs, I mean, he just makes this tiny amount of money, you know, that just barely pays his rent. And he's, you know, he's always grumbling about how he never gets paid for his money. He gets paid for his work. And that if he was a dentist at his age and at his fame, so to speak, or his place and what he has offered society, culture as a whole, his contribution in terms of his novels, he wouldn't have to be worried about where the $350 to pay the loft rent is coming from next month, you know? So one tells him that, you know, like, the interesting thing that happens to poets are that they're kept down to that level of a beginner. I mean, you're always a beginner. You're always more or less in the same socket. Like, Michael Brownstein will freak out that why, you know, like, how come he's only makes $2,000 a year, you know, like, which is, to say the least, below any level of the bottom of society, American society. And he complains, and then William is complaining about the same thing, and William is sort of ultimately at the end of his career and infinitely famous in a certain sense, you know, in relationship to America. And I think it's great for both of them to be in that same place, because it means that you're just, it's always great to be a beginner, because, like, you know, like, if it's racked with anxiety, then it's not so good. But ultimately, it's like you're at a place where there's not too many, you don't have too many protections. And you're still dealing from day to day and doing whatever seems to you like a good idea in your work, or doing all the mirrored things that poets will work at.
Even though wealth doesn't affect poets, it does affect prose writers. Think of Fitzgerald historically and even contemporary novels.
Yeah, you can think of anyone. I mean, if you take Miller. A Norm Miller, well, I mean, what do you get into when you start making $150,000? You start having a few wives, and then you start getting rid of a wife or two, and then you have a couple of children, and all of a sudden you have to make $40,000 off the top just to pay your alimony. And then you're used to living on a certain style of having a house here and a house there, or flying here and flying there. And then it becomes, like, next year, if you don't make $150,000 and you make $2,000, I mean, that's insupportable, because the aspect that has made this condition for all those guys, be they poets or painters, is ego, you know? And then you've got your ego to contend with. I mean, try to feed an ego that's used to $150,000 a year. Try to feed it $2,000, you know, it's just hunger pains.
But isn't that straight across the board, in the sense that the whole society is run on competition, and whether the poet earns $100,000 or $1,000 a year, he is sort of always under that anxiety and pressure to sort of prove his worth by continuing to earn that much amount, since the society evaluate.
Yeah, it's across the board, except, as again, and to a lesser degree, for poets, because poets, no matter who you are, it's hard to get a book published, and when you get a book published, they only print a couple of thousand. And if it sells 2,000, it's a totally huge success coast to coast.
No, John, think of all the poets of the Khalil Gibran Mush ilk who sell in the millions.
Oh, well, that's different. That's not what we're talking about. We're not talking about sort of, I mean, what we're talking about is sort of living, organic poets working in, like,
well, I am thinking of,
and those guys are just living ones, a big box office. And, like, the poets we're involved, at least that I know and work with and involved in, and, I mean, one doesn't want to even enter a judgment about being the best or not best or some, but, you know, like, in terms of their energy, you might say it's like they're more important than some of the poets who, you know, like, are in the supermarket, in the you know, the Safeway store, sold in the Safeway counter. And poets are more interested. I mean, actually, there's one focus that poets, I mean, it's one place where poets' egos sort of get manifest, and that is they like to see their work out. You know, they like to see it published as a book. And so you get, for 2 years' work or a year's work or whatever, $500 advance or $1,000 advance, which on anybody's calculation for a year's work or 2 years is nothing. And then the other way is through poetry readings, you know, like, which, you know, you may, which again is a small return, but poets like to have their work out, you know, like to have it heard or seen or read. And then comes magazines, and magazines generally don't pay anything. And but poets, you know, I mean, this unbelievable, as you know, proliferation of poetry magazines in the last 10 years, so say, where from coast to coast, there's tens of thousands that get published each year, and they publish everywhere. I mean, each magazine has its sort of specialty, and then they all sort of intercross. There's this huge amount of poetry getting published, and that's where poets are really at. You know, that's what they really...
But isn't poetry reading and performance also tending to become a business of sort? I'm thinking of nightclubs and so on that are certainly featuring poetry performances.
The few bars around New York who are uptown, downtown, actually, they're always out of the main... They're always either down in the Bowery or up near Columbia University or in the West Village. It's just a hustle, you know, like it's them ripping poets off. I mean, like one called me 2 days ago, you know, will you do a reading? And what they do is, like, they get this poet there. They give you absolutely no money whatsoever, and they pass the hat around. This is for William Burroughs or for anyone else. And what they do is they can advertise that William Burroughs or whoever is reading at such and such. And what they do is they're making money on the bar, you know. And that's for the ones on the Bowery and all over. So it's just essentially poets being ripped off one more time. Ultimately, though, a poet... will do it, you know, only because, like, he's asked by a friend who's asked by a friend who actually somehow cons him into reading here. And second of all, to get $50 just for and free drinks, you know, like, what the fuck, you know? And you have this audience of people who are drinking in a bar. I mean, they're not totally out to lunch. They're these people, you know? You know, you have some sort of communication with an audience, or it's, you know, why not, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, poets are endlessly ripped off on that. And in that very same way, I mean, the bar, the poets reading in a bar... is a totally typical example. You know, it's the bar business. The first poet we're going to be hearing now is Edwin Denby, reading several poems. These are actually probably the only tapes that exist of Edwin, because he's incredibly difficult. He never reads his poetry. He gave one poetry reading about a year or two ago, and it's the only one he's given in like 30 years. And that wasn't taped. And we got him to come down to my loft. It took us 3 months of calling him all the time to get him to say yes. And then he broke, I don't know how many appointments. You'd be sitting there waiting for him at 4 o'clock, and, you know, then it would be 6, and he wouldn't come. And then finally one day, he came. He read a lot for like an hour. This is sort of 5 minutes of that. He's sort of a grand old man that's even gone beyond that into some... I mean, he's almost transparent. I mean, he's so beautiful and so light. And aggression doesn't sort of enter into... He's very old now and very frail. And there's not too much of his body left. He's like this incredibly marvelous, incredible person now. And his work is the same way. And he's incredibly modest about his work. I mean, he always keeps saying... why do you want me to read my poetry, you know, as it's just these ordinary words. Why should anybody want to tape them? And he has a new book coming out now for the first in an untold number of years called The Collected Works of Edwin Denby. It was a monumental job getting it together because he sort of hated all his old poems. One of the greatest, he would say, oh, you can't use that. It's not good enough to put in any book. And a totally great poem. Anyway, the book's come out, and now finally we've got him... to read some of his poems for us. The first poem he's going to read is called The Shoulder, and then Over Manhattan Island. Then Disorder Mental Strikes Me, and ending up with Suppose There's a Cranky Woman Inside Me.
John, what about this cranky woman inside him? Could you maybe explain that a little bit?
His
cranky old woman is no different than any of our cranky old women that run up with roller skates up and down Armand's, as he would say.
The shoulder of a man is shaped like a baby pig. It terrifies and it bores the observer, the shoulder. The Greeks who had slaves were able to hitch back and rig the shoulder so the eye is flattered and feels bolder. But that's not the case in New York, where a rumor stands around day and night, stupefied with his clothes on. The shoulder hung from his neck, half orchid, half tumor, hangs publicly with a metabolism of its own. After it has been observed a million times or more, a man hunches it against a pole, a jamb, a bench. Parasite he takes no responsibility for. He becomes used to it, like to the exhaust stench. It takes the corrupt ectoplasmic shape of a prayer, or money that connects with the government somewhere. The subway flatters like the dope habit, for a nickel extending peculiar space. You dive from the street, holding like a rabbit, roar up a sewer with a millionaire's face. Squatting in the full glare of the locked express, imprisoned, rocked like a man by a friend's death. Oh, how the immense investment soothes distress. Credit laps you like a huge religious myth. It's a sound effect. The trouble is seeing so anesthetized a square of bare throat, or the fold at the crotch of a clothed human being. You'll want to nuzzle it, crop at it like a goat. That's not in the buy. The company between stops offers you security and free rides to cops. Disorder, mental, strikes me. I slip from my pocket, Dante, to a chance hit a word, a friend's reply in this bar. Bare dark avenue, the lunge of headlights, then bare dark, cross on red, two blocks home, old sixth, the alive, the dead, answer, ask, miracle consciousness I'm with. At home, cat chirps, Norwegian sweater slumped in the bar. I mind Dante. As dawn enters the sunk city, answer one can understand. Actual events are obscure, though the observers appear clear. Suppose there's a cranky woman inside me, who on the prettiest day yanks down the window shade. But what a shade! No mote of light gets through. I breathe in pitch darkness, miserable and afraid. She says she's Whistler's mother, but I've heard her roller skating down the hall when I'm sound asleep, thundering in the dark and yelling bloody murder. She might as well be a subway I happen to keep. At meals, she eats like a wolf. Sometimes, by mistake, dives under the table and bites me, too. If I talk, she makes noises like a hen or a snake. And if I don't, she babbles, "Scrooge you, Scrooge you." She tore up your picture in one of her recent fits, but I felt around for and swallowed all the bits.
To Denby, the next reader, Helen Adams, is really pulls apart. She's such a marvelous performer.
You might say that it's exactly opposite approach to poetry and to reading poetry. Exactly opposite conceptually to what Edwin thinks about the way poetry should be read. You know, that sort of very modestly and with just the words having their own sounds without any person. The person who's reading them inflicting the emotions in the words, or putting emotions into the words, that they should just be clearer in space, you know, which is a really heavy conceptual idea. And Helen Adams she's this London music hall singer, you know, who's this old woman and is incredibly funny and has lived in San Francisco for years and is sort of was a part of that group of Robert Duncan and Jack Spicer and Robin Blazer, and now is living in New York. Actually, this poem was read at St. Mark's Church on New Year's Day. To a packed house, 1,800 people there, or 1,500 people, And in a certain performance sense, it's every poet's dream come true, that you're standing there reading your poem and the audience just starts applauding and clapping and shrieking, and you have to say, there's more coming home. And it's really a totally great performance. So next is Helen Adams reading Cheerless Junkie Song.
Cheerless Junkie Song. Seeking love upon a day of summer's pride. I left Long Island suburbs for the Lower East Side. The train, it roared and thundered, and I sang above its scream. There's a cockroach coming towards me, but it cannot spoil my dream. Love, love, and LSD, it shall not spoil my dream. Blue moon night over Tompkins Square, drop out, tune in, turn on. The village all around me and Long Island suburbs gone. In a pad far down on 4th Street, soon I welcome the approach of the rat that loves the twilight and the nimble-footed roach. Love, love at eventide, the grey rat and the roach. I'm always where the action is. I blow my mind all day while on Long Island's tennis courts the bland suburbans play. And I was born suburban. Who would ever credit that? No chick who saw me frogging with the cockroach and the rat. It's home for horse or method, green to spark the swinging mood. While rats run up my trouser legs, roaches share my food. Rats and roaches nuzzle me when it's dark and hot. Love, love, it's all the same, mixing speed and pot. First a rat and then a roach are both as like as not. If I can't find a fix tonight, my marrow bones will rot. Goodbye, transcendent Tompkins Square, I haven't long to stay. A double jolt of heroin and I'll be on my way. Let rats and roaches bury me, they'll bury me in state as they march from Verrazano Bridge down to the Golden Gate. Clear across the continent, yonder let me lie in the gutters of Haight-Ashbury to freak the passers-by till all the tourists gape and say, brother, he died high. Let rat tails write my epitaph. Brother, he died high.
And she's living out in California, in Point Reyes, California. And she's got this great house right on the water and lives with all her many children who are various ages now, from young women to babies. She's written this long poem called Loba, which probably a lot of people have heard about or heard her read. And this poem, Ave, written a few years ago, just before she began that long poem which she's been working on for maybe, it is actually 3 or 4 years now. She's actually in very good shape. I mean, a few people have run into her this song. Anyway, Diane de Prima reading Ave.
This is a poem called Ave. Ave, like an Ave Maria. It's kind of a poem to all the street women in the world. Sense of myself as stray woman with baby wandering over globe kind of poem. Oh, lost moon sisters, crescent in hair, sea underfoot, do you wander? In blue veil, in green leaf, in tattered shawl, do you wander? With gold leaf skin, with flaming hair, do you wander? On Avenue A, on Bleecker Street, do you wander? On Rampart Street, on Fillmore Street, do you wander? With flower wreath, with jeweled breath, do you wander? Footprints shining, mother of pearl behind you, moonstone eyes in which the crescent moon, with gloves, with hat, in rags, in fur, in beads, under the waning moon, hair streaming in black rain, wailing with stray dogs, hissing in doorways, shadows you are that fall on the crossroads, highways. Jaywalking, do you wander? Spitting, do you wander? Mumbling and crying, do you wander? Aged and talking to yourselves. With roving eyes, do you wander? Hot for quick love, do you wander? Weeping, you're dead. Naked, you walk. Swathed in long robes, you walk. Swaddled in death shroud, you walk. Backwards, you walk. Hungry, hungry, hungry. Shrieking, I hear you. Cursing, I hear you. Praying, I hear you. You lie with the unicorn. You lie with the cobra. You lie in the dry grass. You lie with the yeti. You flick long cocks of satyrs with your tongue. You are armed. You drive chariots. You tower above me. You are small. You cower on hillsides, out of the winds. Pregnant, you wander, barefoot, you wander, battered by drunk men, you wander. You kill on steel tables, you birth in black beds. Fetus you tore out stiffens in snow. It rises like new moon, you moan in your sleep. Digging for yams, you wander, looking for dope, you wander, playing with birds, you wander, chipping at stone, you wander. I walk the long night seeking you. I climb the sea crest seeking you. I lie on the prairie, batter at stone gates, calling your names. You are coral. You are lapis and turquoise. Your brain curls like shell. You dance on hills. Hard substance woman, you whirl. You dance on subways. You sprawl in tenements. Children lick at your tits. You are the hills, the shape and color of mesa. You are the tent, the lodge of skins, the hogan, the buffalo robes, the quilt, the knitted afghan. You are the cauldron and the evening star. You rise over the sea. You ride the dark. I move within you, light the evening fire. I dip my hand in you and eat your flesh. You are my mirror image and my sister. You disappear like smoke on misty hills. You lead me through dream forest on horseback. Large gypsy mother, I lean my head on your back. I am you, and I must become you. I have been you, and I must become you. I am always you. I must become you. Ay-ya, ay-ya, ah, ay-ya, ay-ya, ah, ah. Mayama, mayama, om, star mother, ma, om. Mayama, ah.
Diane de Prima reading Ave, and next is John Cage reading Murrow, which again is sort of opposite the approach to Diane's poem in terms of style and concept.
The juxtaposition is his being very conceptual,
yeah,
and abstract,
yeah,
abstracting poetry.
Yeah, yeah. Sound and space. Taking as he will explain at the beginning of when he reads it, that it's Thoreau and music. That's why it's called Murrow. And he does something of like removing the vowels from the words and then coming up with this new space of language. I mean, so that there's no vowel sounds. You're only hearing consonants. It's music, you know, but and then it's poetry because it's dealing conceptually with words. And it's in sort of very sort of zen-y, sort of empty space, you know, that there, you have empty space and that this is arising in it, this composition, this, you know, poem composition.
John, you mentioned the fact that Murau, the consonants occupy the space, and his theory of silence has been so influential on contemporary art as well as poetry. I was wondering if you'd give some sort of definition to our listener on how his concept of fine silence has affected poetry in general.
Well, people don't generally think about silence, you know. People generally think about filling empty space because of one reason or another, because of some anxiety, you know. John's interest in silence over the years has been just getting people to get into a space that is. I mean, space is basically empty and silent, you know. And that silence is there, and he uses all his many sort of approaches. Like, if you have words, people just think of words as ordinary as the air, you know? I mean, like, you never think that there's actually air that you're breathing, I mean, which is a physical substance, even though you don't see it, you know? But, you know, you just think of air as empty space that's full of air, you know? You don't even think. In this particular thing, here you have words, and what he's doing is removing vowels, which makes you look at the words in a whole other way. I mean, because they're not words that you hear. And then it becomes more of a visceral experience with the sound, and then it becomes a musical experience, as indeed what poetry is anyway.
And in that concept does parallel Thoreau's own ideas.
In silence, John Cage listened to himself, and he heard his respiratory system, you know, when it was all silent, and his circulatory system. And he sort of realized it was never really silent.
Yeah. Actually when you get into the possibilities of silence that you realize there's a deafening din of noise inside you, outside you all the time. If anyone has done retreats, you know, like where you go to a quiet place in the country and set up a very rigid structure of like not having, I mean, it can be called sensory deprivation on one level, but I mean, like if you're just sort of quieting your mind, watching your mind, and stopping all the inputs and like quieting, you know, instead of arriving at silence, one arrives at this incredible amount of noise that goes on around one and inside one's body and one's blood and one's mind and one's heart and one's lungs. It's naturally nothing to be freaked out about. I mean, but the idea is to be aware of it, you know, like when you really quiet everything down and get down to the approaching silence, then you get into sort of the noises which are filling space. To get to sort of a more of an absolute silence, I mean, you deal with that sound and those energies, which again are just totally illusionary. I mean, the way one's mind is filled with noise, so is space filled with sound, but in just as much of a dreamlike or an illusion.
The conventional concept of silence is that there's noise coming in from the outside. The moment you realize that there's noise from the inside as well, that's continuously barraging your eardrums, etc., then the notion of silence becomes an ideal that's virtually
it's
unattainable unless you transcend your own being.
Yeah, on the absolute level, it's sort of the union of those two spaces, the external and the internal.
Well, we arrived at an interesting definition of silence.
Okay.
In public, promise you won't forget, each time we met, we kept our clothes on, despite an obvious intention to take them off. Seldom kissed or even slept, talked to spend desire, worn exhausted from regret. Continue our relationship apart, under surveillance, torture, persecution, confinement, theft. Not mist or sudden blows. When embodied spirits mingle, despite fool's knock, we ride on the great divide of falsehood, hunger, and lost year.
That was John Cage reading Muro. The next three poets, Denise Levitoff, Kenneth Koch, and John Ashbery. Denise Levitoff, is her poem, the poem she's reading is called Life at War, which is one of the earliest of the anti-Vietnam War poems. You might even call it the first anti-war poem. And it's totally a great, great poem and a great reading.
Life at War. The disasters numb within us, caught in the chest, rolling in the brain like pebbles. The feeling resembles lumps of raw dough weighing down a child's stomach on baking day. Or Rilke said it, my heart, could I say of it, it overflows with bitterness, but no. As though its contents were simply balled into formless lumps, thus do I carry it about. The same war continues. We have breathed the grits of it in all our lives. Our lungs are pocked with it. The mucous membrane of our dreams coated with it. The imagination filmed over with the gray filth of it. The knowledge that humankind, delicate man, whose flesh responds to a caress, whose eyes are flowers that perceive the stars, whose music excels the music of birds, whose laughter matches the laughter of dogs, whose understanding manifests designs fairer than the spider's most intricate web, still turns without surprise, with mere regret, to the scheduled breaking open of breasts whose milk runs out over the entrails of still alive babies, transformation of witnessing eyes to pulp fragments, implosion of skinned penises into carcass gullies. We are the humans, men who can make. Beings so lovely, we have believed one another the mirror image of a god we felt as good, who do these acts, who convince ourselves it is necessary. These acts are done to our own flesh. Burned human flesh is smelling in Vietnam as I write. Yes, this is the knowledge that jostles for space in our bodies, along with all we go on knowing of joy, of love. Our nerve filaments twitch with its presence. Day and night. Nothing we say has not the husky phlegm of it in the saying. Nothing we do has the quickness, the sureness, the deep intelligence living at peace would have.
Kenneth Koch reading Spring. This is also a very early poem of Kenneth, and one of his earliest, greatest poems. Kenneth Koch is one of the founding fathers of the New York School of Poetry, the others being Frank O'Hara and John Ashbery, and the three people that are sort of responsible for innovation and evolution of a style of poetry, which essentially grew up in New York amongst the three of them, and then later on to a second generation of poets. It's just sort of an approach of dealing with images from everyday life, incorporating them into poetry, into your poem, the way a poet would incorporate any image in any other sort of more classical or academic approach. It is being a pure image that's used in a poem.
Another poem from the same time called Spring. Let's take a walk in the city till our shoes get wet. It's been raining all night. And when we see the traffic lights and the moon, let's take a smile off the ash can. Let's walk into town. I mean, a lemon peel. Let's make music. I hear the cats, purply beautiful like hallways in summer, made of snowing rubber, valence, piccalilli, and diamonds. Oh, see the arch ruby of this late March sky. Are you less intelligent than the pirate of lemons? Let's take a walk. I know you tonight as I have never known a book of white stones or a bookcase of orange groans or symbolism. I think I'm in love with those imaginary racetracks of red traced gray in the sky and the gimcracks of all you know and love, who once loathed firecrackers and license plates and diamonds, but now you love them all, and just for my sake. Let's take a walk into the river. I can even do that tonight. Where if I kiss you, please remember with your shoes off, you're so beautiful, like a lifted umbrella, orange and white. We may never discover the blue overcoat, maybe never, never. Oh, blind with this, love, let's walk into the first rivers of morning as you are seen to be bathed in a light, white light. Come on.
That was Kenneth Koch reading Spring. And next is John Ashbery reading A Blessing in Disguise, which is also a very early great poem of John Ashbery's, one of his earliest.
Yes, they are alive and can have those colors, but I in my soul am alive too. I feel I must sing and dance to tell of this in a way that knowing you may be drawn to me. And I sing amid despair and isolation of the chance to know you, to sing of me, which are you. You see, you hold me up to the light in a way I should never have expected or suspected, perhaps, because you always tell me I am you and right. The great spruces loom. I am yours to die with, to desire. I cannot ever think of me, I desire you, for a room in which the chairs ever have their backs turned to the light, inflicted on the stone and paths, the real trees that seem to shine at me through a lattice toward you. If the wild light of this January day is true, I pledge me to be truthful unto you, whom I cannot ever stop remembering. Remembering to forgive. Remember to pass beyond you into the day on the wings of the secret you will never know, taking me from myself in the path which the pastel girth of the day has assigned to me. I prefer you in the plural. I want you. You must come to me, all golden and pale like the dew in the air. And then I start getting this feeling of exaltation.
John has just come out with a new book that's called Self-Portrait in a Convex Mirror, which is actually probably some of the greatest work he's ever done. And we will conclude with Charles Stein reading Seed Poem. Charles is a young poet, and this poem is really totally great. It's like the first time he did something like this, but it just worked in this totally amazing way.
This is a seed poem called Vajra Guru Padma Didshi. Rage, judge, raga, mad judge, rage, a mad judge rages, a raga rives, a raga judges, a rug, a jug, a mug, mud. A mage judge rides as a mud rug, a mad judge rides as a mud mage rages, a vase, a raid, jade, a jade vase. A mad judge graves a jade vase. A mad maid judges a mud jug, a jade vase. A mud maid judges a rum jug, a jade vase. I am a gum jug. I raise a mud vase. I phase. I praise a jade rug. I judge a gum jar, a jade jug. I jam a gum jug. A gum jug rises. A mud rug rides. I am a mage rug. I made a mage jug a gum mug. A jade mug, a jade jug, a jade rug, a jade vase, a jade. He made a mud jade rise, praise him. He made a jade jug, he made a gem. He made a gem rise, he made a mud gem ride, he made a gem judge rise, praise him. He said, a gum jug am I, a jade vase am I raise a gem jug as a mud rug I ride. I made gum, I made jam, I made red mud, I made a drum, I hum, he said, hum. I made a mud gem rise. A mad maid made a med jug, she made med, she said judge. She made a jade judge, he read. She made him drum, she made him rage, she made him, she said, jug gem, rug gem, mud red gem, drug gem, drug judge gem, rug gem, red rug gem, jug gem, judge. Judge said, praise him.
You have been listening to readings by Edwin Denby, Helen Adam, Diane DePrima, John Cage, Denise Levertov, Kenneth Cook, John Ashbery, and Charles Stein. The readings in this program were introduced by John Giorno, and he was interviewed by Charles Ruas and Linda Perry. All readings in this program are available on the Dial a Poem Poets series LP records, available at book and record shops, or by writing to Giorno Poetry Systems, 222 Bowery, New York, New York, 10012. This program was produced by Linda Perry, with assistance by Mark Newick, executive producer Charles Ruas, and technical production by Peter Zanger. Thank you for listening.
You have been listening to Dial a Poem with John Giorno and guests, an Art International radio production of a restored 1975 recording from the historic audio archives of Charles Ruas.
The previous program was produced by Clock Tower Radio, clocktower.org, and is broadcast in partnership with Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM.